Hello and welcome to the RTE Rugby World Cup podcast. You're coming to us just as we saw France eventually dispatch the US 12-9 with a couple of minutes to go, but they ran in three tries. So I suppose that kind of match reverted to the mean, everybody expecting them to win by about 20. That's how it happened. Hopefully the same will happen tomorrow. We'll talk to Eddie O'Sullivan in a sec. Wes Liddy is here in studio with me as well. Wes, open it up. Where are we? Less than 24 hours out from Do or Die versus Russia.
We seem to have calmed down from the hysteria after the weekend. Whether the hysteria was justified or not was widely debated by mostly by non-rugby followers, it seems, who took umbrage that the team didn't get enough of a kicking, perhaps. I agree to a point, I suppose, and other bits I don't agree on. I suppose the selection is interesting insofar as we probably had this earmarked as a game where there'd be a lot of rotation, and there's been some, but there is a couple of anomalies, some kind of self-imposed with, you know, the likes of Carey and Robbie Henshaw injured, kind of limits your options a bit. And, you know, some, like, you know, Johnny, I suppose, is a similar boat, but I suppose it does become a slight concern in that if you play today, you know, you would imagine that you'd like to not go. We've 10 days now, I think, to Samoa, and then in a further week to a quarterfinal. So I don't think you're going to leave anyone 3 weeks without action. So you do kind of almost unknowns to yourself possibly and arrive in a situation where people are rocking up into their fifth game on the trot in a quarterfinal, which was maybe something we wanted to avoid. So, yeah, it's kind of hard to get your finger on that one. But I have been struck by, I was listening to Joe Schmidt yesterday and the mood seemed remarkably positive, really. So, you know, it's almost like the Japan one has been chalked up as well. We just lost to a team that were better than us on the day, which is true. We still lost to Japan in a Rugby World Cup, though, so it's very hard to know how tempered or not you should be in dissecting it.
It's impossible to get a reliable fix on the form lines because we look good against Scotland, but Scotland played the perfect game for Ireland because they try and play perfect rugby without perfect rugby players. And it, you know,
I thought they were poor enough yesterday as well, even though they got a big win in the end. I don't think they're great.
They stumbled home, didn't they? Yeah.
I mean, I suppose there's just the whole thing of peaking for tournaments as well. I mean, you know, Eddie'll know better than anyone, but you know, the official line has always been that the Six Nations in and of itself is the be all and end all for us. And it is. You don't win it that often, and obviously in terms of revenue it's huge. So, you know, for whatever reason, some other countries have a knack of lifting their game on a four-yearly basis, and we don't seem to have that. And we've probably, you know, look, we're not maybe the world beaters we were in 2018. We're not maybe a disaster zone just yet. The reality is we've probably reverted to historical type, and we'll get to a quarterfinal, and then that'll be that. If you were trying to find the middle ground.
Sure. I mean, yeah. The bottom line is Japan will need 2 points from their Scotland, from the game against Scotland, which is the day after our game versus Samoa. So let's just bring it back to the pool stages for now. I mean, again, it worked out well for us in terms of the calendar. If we get the 5 points from both games, our last game is Saturday the 12th, then Sunday the 13th, we can sit back and watch Scotland and Japan go at it. Scotland will have to beat Japan, which would more or less guarantee us top spot. Japan will have to beat Scotland to guarantee top spot for them. So despite the disaster and the optics of a loss to Japan, we're not in a bad position. But the problems, Eddie, are deeper. When you're looking at the team, you're just looking at these lads saying, in the current form, on all evidence that we've seen recently, they won't beat a big side. But I suppose that's for another day.
Well, yeah, I think, and that's where the narrative is going with the team. At the moment, the messages coming out of camp are everything's great. We're back on track. You know, even though technically you could say they're not back on track, but they're taking the Japan result on the chin, as Wesley said, that the better team in the day won. Joe Schmidt after the game referenced, you know, they're a good side and you only have to be a little bit off against them and you get caught. And we got caught, so that's the narrative. But, you know, no need to panic. And yeah, you can go with actually most of what he said there. I wouldn't have a major issue. That's his job, is to get everybody's nose pointing in the same direction. It's still in our own hands, no question about that. And I still think we'll end up with 16 points. And I still think we've a chance at topping the group, although it's a moot point. The most important thing is to get out of it. Like, you can expect them to move away from that, but it still does leave a bad taste in the mouth that we lose to Japan. I mean, Japan are a tier two nation. They're a very good tier two nation. But the nature of the defeat as well does send a shiver down a lot of guys' spines, because we were in a position to win that game. Like, after 20, 25 minutes, we were in control of the game. And in the space of, 20 minutes in the second half, we lost it. And that's a worry, And I think that's in the back of the mind now. And any time we get in a sticky situation and for the rest of the tournament, those kind of bad memories of Japan will come flooding back in the heat of battle. There's no question about that. And I just thought the other tactic in terms of dealing with the media was to highlight the inadequacies of the referee last weekend, which I don't know, is there any value in that in any sense? Because in a way it can come across as, only for the referee we would have won. But at the same time, we don't want to take anything away from Japan, which is kind of a contradiction. Mm. And I think that it doesn't do us any good going forward. And it's stewing over something that can't be changed, So I think the overall is they're trying to be positive. They're trying to kind of justify the Japanese game in their heads and hopefully get on and give Russia a good kicking tomorrow and get that feel-good feeling back that we all had after Scotland. So I can understand the way the narrative is going, but I think, Wesley pointed out there that the result against Japan, that is going to linger not too far below the surface. And if we get in a sticky situation, which I doubt will happen against Russia or Samoa, in fact, but in the quarterfinal, whoever we're playing, if we get in a sticky situation there, like those horror moments from last weekend do flood back into the mind if we get ourselves in a pickle. And fellas can panic just as much as they did last weekend at certain times.
Well, I agree with you in principle, Eddie, but was it less about horror moments than just a kind of an awful torpor and stagnation that came over the team on the field for that second 40 minutes?
Well, I've looked at the game again in quite a bit of detail, and, there were moments in that game that if we had put another score on the board, we'd have probably won the game reasonably comfortably. I'm not saying we'd have run away with 30 points, but we could have had a two-score cushion going into the last 10 minutes.
Sure.
Instead of trying to chase the game. Those moments were pretty much self-inflicted. That's the problem. Like, giving Japan credit where credit is due, and they did really play well, and they played a really nice brand of rugby, you can see where we self-inflicted the wounds that hurt us. And the problem with that is the lads, the players and the staff know how it happened. They've analysed the game. They know where we went awry. And the consideration is that if we get another pickle again, we could go awry again very easily. It's a kind of a space in your head that kind of haunts you when you lose a big game like that, particularly against opposition you're supposed to beat. And it's easy in the context of the tournament to go back there again. It's not far below the surface. So, I just thought we lost our sense of direction in that game. Partly, I think, because we backed away from what we were doing well in the first half for some strange reason. And the consequence of that is we kind of put fuel in the Japanese tank and they came at us in waves. So, like, that was our own doing. So that's there. And, the next time we find ourselves in that pickle, if we do, hopefully not in this tournament, but we could, then it all comes flooding back. So that makes us vulnerable at the moment. I can't see it happening against Russia. I can't really see it happening against Samoa, because I think they'll be out on their feet by the time they play us.
Mm-hmm.
But were it to happen against Samoa for some daft reason, you could imagine guys getting into that mode again. Now, personnel might be different. I still believe if Johnny Sexton was on the field last Saturday or last Sunday, we would have won, I think that, he would have steered the ship home. I think Carty hadn't the experience and Carberry hadn't the games under his belt, and that was a big problem. And as a consequence now, we find Sexton being trotted out for this game, which he should really be off his feet for the Russian game. But he wasn't picked for Japan for some strange reason. I mean, Japan, the two big threats in our pool were Scotland and Japan. You would have thought you'd want your best halfbacks on the field to make sure nothing went awry. And he opted not to go with Sexton. The word is he was fit, but he was rested. Now he's forced to go with Sexton tomorrow and potentially against Samoa, which could have ramifications down the track for Sexton if he has to play a bundle of games now on the trot. When we need him most, he might be pretty beaten up come the quarter final. But that's another discussion, I suppose.
So overall, where we stand here on the eve of the Russian match, Wes, is that people think we're kind of a wounded beast that's slightly staggering towards a quarter final that no one expects us to win.
Yeah, I suppose in a nutshell it is. I mean, I don't know, it's not a science, but you always get a sense of energy and purpose and momentum off a team. Even in defeat at times, you look at the way fixtures will fall, you look at what players might return, you look at the way things are evolving, and you get a sense that might be a kick in this.
Mm.
You don't really get that sense at the minute.
You really don't. I mean, looking and sticking with that point, energy, which is a vague term, but I think everyone understands who's watched the games. I mean, at around 55, 60 minutes, Japan were getting quick rock ball.
I think the problem started much earlier. I think it started about 25 minutes.
Okay, well, I'll give you a very amateur man's view on it. When we got a rock ball, even if it was quick, we seemed to slow the pace of the game down. I mean, every time an Irish player touched the ball, the tempo of the game dropped. Every time a Japanese player touched the ball, the tempo of the game upped.
Well, I think, like Eddie did a piece of analysis on the programme the other day where, you know, we were trying to outflank them for a time in the first half, and there was kind of a strange contradiction between that approach from distance and then tightening up once we got within, in our usual fashion, once we got within a certain amount of their line. And look, that's the way the game is at the minute. Teams are trying to pick and jam their way or use a cross kick to get around that packed area either side of the ruck, but they looked a bit muddled in what they were trying to do. Fatigue could have played its part in that, aided by conditions, and, you know, it happens to anyone, least of all when you're playing in a World Cup, but in a sense, equally it's irrelevant because it is what it is and you've got to deal with it or not.
What will be interesting today is the All Blacks and Canada, right? And they're about 70-point favourites on it, and you'd expect them to run in a sackful, but it's going to be humid. The balls are famously going to be greasy and slippy. So let's see if the All Blacks struggle to pin it together for 80 minutes, and then we can say, okay, yeah, there is something over there that's over and above what we understand as Paddy's over here in terms of the impact of the conditions.
Yeah, they won't. I mean, they'll score a hatful of points. They do it in a teeming wet night in Hamilton regularly, that they'd string passes from one side of the field to the other. Their basic skills are excellent, as we all know, so there's not going to be a problem with them putting
points
up.
They'll spill a few, but they'll still score 8 or 10.
Yeah. They kind of seem to lean into that risk, that it's like almost an inevitable product of trying to play the way they want
like
to play.
I like that phrase, Eddie, lean into the risk, because when you look at Ireland, you sense they're a bit frightened.
Well, they certainly are after the weekend, but to touch on the point that you made earlier, I think Wesley made there, was that the first 25 minutes, we were not afraid of anything. You know, like going through that game again, we had that first 22, 23 minutes, we played some great rugby. Ringrose had two cracking breaks, one which led to a try. We double skipped, which you rarely see from Ireland, to Stockdale, who was put away. We were dominant in the scrum. We two tries scored. And, you know, we even from the restart of the second try, Carty cross kicked to Earls, and we were 60 metres up the field. Like, it was all on, like, it was go for it. And then we got sloppy and we got a couple of penalties pinged against us, and suddenly it's 12-9 at half time. Now, we said in the studio, we've got a game here in our hands, but the second half, we just strung together like bad moments when we had them where we needed to score again and really kind of take the fizz out of them. We lost the line out. That Grubber kicked that O'Mahony put through, and suddenly they were up the touchline. You know, Earls missed a tackle, and then we had then it started to really go downhill with the collision between Stander and Farrell, which led to the scrum, which led to the try. You know, and then when we're now in trouble, and we had a couple of sorties where we did slow down the game, like you talked about. We played phases across and kicked the ball away, you know, and we just kind of lost our mojo completely. And at one stage there, like, We had a 4-2 overlap and Carberry just carried the ball into contact. It had panic written all over it. And then when we got the turning point in the game, the final nail in our coffin was after those sorties to save ourselves where we got turned over. Japan got a scrum outside our 22 and they moved it wide and they moved it wide again and they moved it wide again. And suddenly Murray was penalised at the ruck 40 metres out and they kicked the killer, you know, they kicked the extra three to put them seven points away. So, like, it was like a team dismantling itself, like, in slow motion in front of us. And that's a worry. That is a worry because, you know, we're not particularly good. And Ireland, you could say this about Ireland across the board, going back over the years, we're not particularly good at digging ourselves out of a hole. We just tend to buy a new shovel when we're in a hole, you know, and get on with it. Like, and that was evident last weekend. And I don't think that goes away. I think that's there at the moment. Joe Schmidt's teams have been great at grinding out results, getting in front and basically, you know, shutting you out, you know, just squeezing the life out of you. And when we need to squeeze the life out of Japan on the weekend, we strung together a series of errors which just breathed life into them. And that's atypical of Ireland historically, and it's very atypical of Ireland under Joe Schmidt. So, you know, I think that is a worry going forward. I don't just a worry against Russia. I can't imagine it's going to be a worry against Samoa, but it would be a worry going into the knockout stages. And we saw it 4 years ago when Argentina got us early doors and put us under the cosh. We never recovered, you know. So that's maybe part of our DNA. Maybe even Joe Schmidt can't change that. But we're not under his ear. We've been good at not putting ourselves in that position of being in a hole. And we were in a hole again last weekend, and we couldn't find a way out. In fact, we dug even deeper, Fenton.
Yeah, and looking back at it, I think, you know, I know it's a different team now, and it's 6 years ago, but the best performance possibly was the losing performance against the All Blacks at the end of 2013, and we raced into a lead, and we came out into that game as somebody with a team with pedestrian enough form, and all of a sudden we were playing this incredibly high tempo, risky running rugby, and you just can't see that happening now. It doesn't need to happen tomorrow, it doesn't need to happen against Samoa, but it'll need to happen at some stage, because as we go back to the principal theme of this tournament, we've just been bullied by Japan, so to think that we won't be bullied by either New Zealand or South Africa is a fallacy. Wes?
I don't think we were bullied, to be honest with you. I think we were ran around the place.
I thought we lost more than our fair share of collisions. Bullying, maybe a bit.
Like, without getting too philosophical about it, I think there's, even if you're doing the wrong thing, but you're doing it with conviction and belief, is sometimes better than not being quite sure what you're trying to do. Mm. And I think that was a bit of a difference between the two teams. As Eddie said, though, there was an overthrown line-out by Rory Bestdeep in the 22. That spot play they tried with Joey Carberry, which, I agree with Eddie that there was a bit of rustiness in Carberry's decision to step back inside. Equally, Rob Kearney wasn't anywhere near the position he needed to be in to receive that ball, which could have been a thing with fatigue and rustiness, with him having missed a few games himself at that point. Conor Murray kicked two box kicks in the first 49 minutes, one straight into the stands, one to contest. Mm. They won the one to contest. They didn't kick again till the 69th minute. Mm. That was spilled. Rob Kearney gathered it. We made another break into 22, subsequently penalised at a breakdown. So what I'm saying in putting all that together is, A, we just didn't take chances. The opportunity to dig ourselves out of the hole, so to speak, was there in abundance.
Sure.
And B, there was a complete turn away from tactic that has not only been historically fruitful, but was fruitful within the microcosm of that game. And this is a very experienced player in Conor Murray, who's the best kicking scrum half in the world over the last number of years, probably since Fory Dupreez. And we just didn't pursue that. So there was no coherence to the way we tried to chase it. It was very frazzled. And we haven't seen enough big hitters against each other games in the tournament yet to know. But I think possibly because of the conditions, possibly because of increases in ball and play or whatever, I think it's the teams who maximise their purple patches within games, the most clinical teams that'll ultimately triumph in this tournament now. You could say it was ever thus, but I suppose it's a slightly different point if you look at New Zealand against South Africa.
I was just thinking of that game.
It's a perfect example where I can't even really remember a clean line break by New Zealand other than within that 6-minute window. So
17 points.
And you look at South Africa and the difference in them when they're ahead or behind and their capabilities. And I think Ireland are similar in that they're maybe not the greatest front. You know, if they fall behind, they're possibly in trouble. So the most pleasing thing about the Scotland game, which again, even though we were all raving about it, it wasn't this total 80-minute constant dominance display. It was a display that when opportunities presented themselves, we switched into this mode. We were absolutely ruthless and clear on our purpose, and we took advantage of them. And that's the hallmark, I think, that's going to see teams progress in this tournament. And it was the exact opposite that was was in evidence against Japan, you'd have to say.
So, Eddie, I mean, it's not about finger pointing in a pejorative way, but like the players didn't solve it on the pitch for that second 40 minutes. And players like Conor Murray and, you know, and Wes has just listed his CV. So what's that about?
I can only speculate, as you say. I don't know for sure, but there's a couple of possibilities. Like, if you look at that first 20 minutes compared to the last, you know, 20 minutes of the game, you have to ask yourself the question, what changed? And it's the way we were playing changed. We'd stopped backing ourselves into the outside channels where we were making really good headway and causing Japan to scramble to get to rucks. And then there was holes in the line when we did go for the runners off 9 or off 10. We stopped doing that. Was that a decision just by the coaching staff at halftime? Let's knuckle down here. Let's kick down the field, get field position. Let's, you know, go back to what we do well. Get scrums and lineouts outside their 22 and just grind them down and take your 3 points and eke ahead. And if they were an over them, take your 5 points and go back to halfway. Kind of that trench warfare mentality. That didn't work because we actually didn't execute well, as Wesley pointed out, with a lot of inaccuracies. Was it just that we changed our headset, or was it kind of a fear factor came in? You know, it's like it gives a sense that this ship is starting to take water and guys panic and go off script. So there was definitely a shift in tactics.
But did guys go off script, do you think? Or was it just they didn't know how to? They were so programmed to stay within their tiny little one line in the script, and, you know?
Well, the point I'm making is that we certainly had a script in the first half that was working for us.
Right.
Up to 25 minutes. Now we got sloppy and we left them back in before half time with a few penalties. But that first 25 minutes, I'm pretty sure was what was the plan going on the field, and it was working. No question, it was working. Now, the second half of my point is, was the plan the same or was it changed? My guess is it changed, because I think looking at our body language, we went back into territory mode. Let's stay in their third of the field and play down there. I think there was a change in tactics. We didn't continue to back ourselves like we had. Maybe the fact that we lost control of the last 15 minutes of the first half, we got edgy and decided, look, well, let's not muck around here. We're in the lead here. We've scored a couple of tries. They haven't scored a try. Let's pin them back. But it didn't work. And like, once we started taking water, and I think we started taking water maybe before half time, maybe that caused the rethink at half time, or certainly early in the second half, we were taking water. In terms of not executing, then I think guys did panic a little bit. There wasn't that security we normally have at 9 and 10. And I think, you know, Jack Carty was never going to bring that gravitas to that position. You know, he's a rookie in that position, so it was a bit much to ask of him. Conor Murray probably should have stood up to the plate, but as Wesley said there, Conor Murray didn't really play particularly well. In fact, he jumped offside for the final penalty. Now maybe there's a penalty there already, but if you freeze the film on that penalty that could have gave him a 7-point spread, Conor Murray was about 2 yards offside. Like, for a player of his experience under that much pressure, he should have been the guy to hold his head. And other guys, it's not just on Conor Murray's neck. I mean, it was like, you know, Peter O'Mahony had we remember him more for his sloppiness at the rock than more than Anton. You know, I mean, I don't know what kind of leadership he was bringing. He seemed to be under huge pressure as well. And the thing about rugby, when teams are under pressure, and Rory Best, the captain, obviously, when teams are under pressure, the one thing players will tell you on the field is everything goes quiet. And that's that guys stop talking. And if your leaders stop talking, you're in big trouble. Like, the ship is now listing badly. And you got a sense on the weekend that when we were when we were in trouble, like when it was obvious, like we're you know, likely to lose this game, Japan are rising here. There seems to be that lack of I suppose leadership on the field, which is not a good thing to see. Now, you could say, well, if Sexton was there, he's the one guy can change that. He's the one guy that circles the guys up behind the posts and he gets into everybody and everybody settles down. And maybe that's true, I don't know. And maybe that's why Joe Schmidt has him on the field tomorrow when he probably should be off his feet against Japan or against Russia. Certainly that was missing. That was missing in Japan when we were kind of, we're still in the game. Like, they didn't score, you know, quite late in the game. You know, they scored, it was in the 59th minute they scored, 60th minute before they took the lead. And you still, and it's a one-score game. You think, well, we can still work our way out of this, but we went on and kind of lost our way completely in that last 20 minutes. And you'd wonder then, where was the leadership? You know, where's the guys who are going to keep the head? And I thought that was evident. I think, yeah, a lot of guys panicked. That's why I saw the panic coming in.
We were all looking for it. It just didn't happen. It just didn't. We were thinking it could have been James Ryan. It could have been Peter. It could have been.
I think the last few days. I mean, again, it's anecdotal, but I think it's absolutely confirmed that Johnny Sexton is the absolute alpha in this team. Mm-hmm. From even his body language, watching the game from the stands, to feeling he had to come down onto the pitch at half time to clap guys off, to fronting up to the media twice in the interim, to being played at all against Russia.
And there's no doubt. Captaining.
And he was put in, he was often lumped with Connor, it was Murray and Sexton, yes. And, you know, there was other leaders in the team. But I think there's no doubt now who's viewed as the key piece by management and who, more importantly, sees himself as the key piece and is willing to take on that decision-making. I mean, when I hear...
I think you're right, and I'm glad you distilled it down, because, like, we've nowhere else to go that isn't vague. But
I hear fellas, and I agree with it, but when I hear talk about, like, not being able to think for yourself or going quiet or not breaking from the plan, like, that's really disappointing to hear about a group of grown men that are highly paid, that, like, they can't break away from the plan. I mean... That's life. Like, I mean, make a decision. You know, sorry, I know it sounds... It's very... It annoys me much more, that inability to take responsibility, than a lack of skill execution. I just can't understand that kind of side of things, to be honest.
That's what we're struggling to understand in this discussion too, aren't we? We were trying to say...
There's that Murray Mechstead, the famous All Black, who's a commentator in New Zealand now, has this famous phrase, you know, which is kind of bastardised by some journalists in this country, but the ebb and flow of psychic energy calls the swing of momentum in matches. And
it's still the best way of putting it,
It's brilliant, though, and it's you start off, you're playing really well, you're cock of the walk, you've just beaten Scotland, then things go awry, the opposition come back at you, you get edgy because you're overwhelming favourites, you play with a bit inhibited, they sense those mistakes, they play a cavalier game, the crowd respond, and it becomes this perfect storm that's very hard to reverse. And there is a bit of that, and that goes some way to explaining how, like when you said, we were so poor prior to the All Blacks game in 2013 and we just turned up. That's why you can turn things around from one game to another, because moments and matches have lives of their own. But we can't really pin all our hopes to an irrational one-off either.
Well,
so
why not?
It's very hard to know how to really view it. I think we're all willing and hoping that there will be somehow a miraculous one-off.
An uptick in psychic energy,
Or a revert back to the form of what at this point is 18 months ago, you know?
Well, if you're so finely drilled and tightly drilled that you believe that things like psychic energy are just too nebulous, that it's all about, like, your foot position at the breakdown and all the rest of it, maybe you forget that there is intangibles that can switch a game. I don't know, and that's just something that comes to you in the moment. But, like, is it drilled out of them? I know it's a simplistic way of looking at it.
They've probably gotten into a pattern where they're extremely comfortable following a pattern, and they believe wholly in it, and that starts to feed itself in terms of confidence when they get reward from one or two things. And obviously when that doesn't happen, you go, oh, what next? But I don't think that should excuse you from not coming up with what's next as a group of highly paid grown men out in the field. You know, it's not, we're not asking people to decide whether to go over the trench or not. We're just saying, do you know what, you could have kicked the ball a couple of times more. It's not life or death. I don't see what the problem with decision making should be.
Which brings us to the media reaction and the public reaction. It is good, isn't it, as a vehicle for some sort of weird class struggle, I don't know, what goes on. Eddie, I mean, Ireland has changed so massively in the last 20 or 30 years. But I couldn't quite figure out the anti-rugby sentiment here, because the anti-rugby sentiment seemed to be coming from a kind of an urban audience that would be equally at home slagging country people. So now they were slagging kind of South County Dublin yuppies, and they were... Where does that leave them? I think, sure, rugby has misrepresented as a sport of people who fancy themselves, basically, rather than have money. I suppose there is a cohort of rugby supporters who, to use the marvellous North Inner City Dublin term, tend to smell themselves.
Well, yeah, it's a sociology lecture, really. I think what we probably forget, and this is as you're talking in broad brush strokes, the demographics of rugby have changed dramatically. Like my first kind of, this going back 15 years ago now, is like realization that rugby had a different audience. Was you know, if you walk through towns in Ireland, like, you know, down the Midlands and that, people are walking around in rugby jerseys, you know. They're a fashion item.
Munster,
and
mightn't be
an Irish rugby jersey. It could be the Wellington Hurricanes. And not alone have they never been to Wellington, they've never seen a hurricane. So that demographic has changed. So that's a fact of life. And that's a great thing, because more people are watching the game, more people are interested in the game. But the problem with that as well is that's built on the back of an Irish rugby team that in the past, say, 15 years, has won more games than it's lost.
Mm.
You know, there was a time in Irish rugby when, if you go back to the 90s, two wins in the Five Nations was celebrate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whereas two wins in the Six Nations is a coach could probably lose his job, as we know.
Yeah.
And that's the expectations change.
Why is Simon Gagan still famous, you know?
yeah. Well, and the other thing is there's a lot of kids now really engrossed in rugby across, they're also engrossed in soccer, they're also engrossed in Gaelic football. You know, in the heartland of Ireland, where it was normally either rugby or soccer, those kids now have no idea who the guys were who played back in the early noughties even. You know, like the guys, like, they don't know really Mick Galway, it's sacrosanct to say, but they don't know Keith Wood, they don't know Peter Clancy. You know, they don't know those names we think are iconic, because we grew up in the game. But the bottom line is you've a lot more people following the game with much higher expectations, which is fine, it's okay, and it should be that way, because we are in a different space. But then you're going to get a more visceral reaction when things go wrong, because we all know everybody has a say, everybody's a publisher, so that's very easy to access everybody's opinion. And at times that can be a bit shocking, you know, because... I just think there's always going to be people out there who will probably take some enjoyment in the team losing. I'm sure there are people who enjoy the Irish soccer team losing.
There's something weird. There's something that's a suggestion that if you're a kind of a casual rugby supporter, that you're betraying something not particularly wholesome about yourself, that you fancy yourself. I don't know. I mean, and when the role models that you refer to are Mick Galway, they'd be role models for my generation as well, and I could relate to them.
I think it's the casualness, you say, though, that maybe irks some people.
Yeah.
Like...
Oh, what, you have to wake up in the morning and, like, you know, do your 10 times tables about rugby statistics to prove your worth, or you have to have a season ticket.
No, but I think there is a sense and a truth that if a million people watch a big Six Nations or World Cup match and a million people watch the All-Ireland final, I think there's a far higher percentage of the million watching the rugby match that are interested in passing. It's not intrinsic to their actual daily lives. It's something that's new. It's something that's curiosity. It's something that's, you know, it's great, I'm really behind the team, but, you know, I'm not going to lose much sleep about it.
It's sport. It's a break in the battle. You know?
I'm not saying I feel that way.
No, I know.
But I think people, like...
Are we not entitled to have a break in the battle, even if we don't know, like, a blind side from a tight head?
I think some of the jingoism in the marketing of rugby is problematic.
Some of the language is
rugby country,
to Ross O'Carroll,
team
Kelly.
Of us,
yeah.
All this crack, trying to maybe give it a place that it didn't have. And you could say that's the purpose of marketing, but it is cannon fodder for when things go
but
wrong.
But it also seems to be very corporate language. And what's amused me
and
is...
And it's ill-conceived, to be perfectly blunt about it. It's poor.
But also, don't people really want to get away from the corporate world and the world of money? And like when they're actually sold the sport using the vocabulary of the boardroom, it's just, oh, Jesus, give us a break. Like,
I think all the jargon that's associated with the game itself and then some of that stuff, I think when Ireland are winning, to the person who's kind of a casual follower, that becomes like interesting and exciting and cutting edge. But equally when Ireland are losing, it's like, how would you go out of it, lads? Get a hold of yourselves kind of stuff. It's kind of as simple as that. And look, I think there is a bit of like an echo chamber that goes on within rugby administration. I think there is a bit of a we know best.
Yes.
I think they're not accountable to the general public in a broad, vague sense the way the GAA are. I think they're not, because they're professional, they can do what they want to a certain extent. And because they're not in every corner of the country, they can probably take a bit more liberties, and it's kind of hidden in all that jargon that goes with the administration and the playing of the game. It kind of distances people from it a bit so that they can make decisions without necessarily taking the same heed of what the average punter thinks, whether that be ticket prices, jersey prices, television rights, whatever. It's irrefutable that the IRFU have done dozens of things that the GAA wouldn't get away with in a month of Sundays. And that's part of the backlash as well, I think.
Eddie?
Yeah, it's
there's no answers here, it's just a chat.
There is no answers, but I think there's I agree with what Wesley says to an extent. In the sense that, yeah, the rugby is always seen as a step apart, but I think we're very early in the rugby story. Like, the professional game is 25 years old. The Irish rugby team as an entity, the provinces in terms of their success and their recognition outside Ireland, even, you know, the Munster and Leinster, and the way the four provinces now are part and parcel of the narrative almost on a weekly basis. The fact that more people now, even at provincial level, there are people who go to provincial games, their Leinster hats on and or their Connacht jerseys or whatever. And as I keep saying, that's not a criticism, but they have no connection with the club game in the country.
That's never going to happen again. I mean, we can forget about that. That'll never happen. I mean, we are into an area now where it's just one big block of entertainment that people will go to. I mean, Irish people don't like to see themselves as McGalway anymore. They like to see themselves as beautiful, successful, fit, and minutely focused on their job and driving big cars. Like, there is an element of that. We live in a very competitive society. I'm not saying that I'm any better than these people, but like, that seems to be the driving factor, is like to present this beautiful life. And I suppose rugby players kind of do that. There are only homegrown kind of celebs.
Well, the other thing is that they're on a celebrity status, for say, with our international soccer team. That they're as well known as a lot of our international soccer.
They're better
players.
Known these days. They're better.
But
known.
They are more. They are way more accessible.
They're better known in Ireland.
They're better known in Ireland, yeah. But I mean,
yeah. But we're talking about the Irish public. They're also much more accessible than soccer players. And the other thing about
I think rugby shows up a mirror to modern Ireland, and it doesn't like some of what it sees.
But I think my point about the connection with the province and no connection with the club, that's a big difference between basically rugby and Gaelic games.
Like, yes.
Most people who follow Gaelic games and are really entrenched in the game have a connection, but the parish connection is there. You know, the local football team, the local hurling team, that connection doesn't exist. There isn't that parish connection. I think it's for parish, because parish is the defining thing in sport.
So it's hollow in the middle, Eddie, is another way of putting that. The connection that a lot of people have with rugby is hollow in the middle, and maybe some of these resentful commentators have spotted something in that, and it's given them great glee.
If you're following the Cork hurlers, by and large, you also have a local club that you've been involved with, that you're aware of to some degree. But as Eddie says, and this is from someone who... Like, where I grew up, the rugby club fulfilled all the social function that a GAA club does in most parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
you know, everyone had their 21st there. Everyone went down and played. All the socialising was done there in the rugby club.
In Munsters.
In Young Munsters, yeah. Not in the GA club. Mm-hmm. It was done there.
Mm-hmm.
But if people don't have a connection to that, well, then their connection with rugby extends to what they watch on TV.
Yes.
Now, how could that be possibly as visceral or as close as something that you actually engage with in your day-to-day life? It couldn't.
Well, hang on a while. I mean, if you go back to Cork hurling, like my own experience of that would have been going to a few games in Parky Kiev. And then, of course, when they go well, you travel, you go to Thurles or you go to Dublin and you watch it on television. Like, of course, it's a different generation. I'm talking about 30 years ago and into the 90s. That would have given me a huge affinity with Cork hurling. The success was part of it as well. But to be part of a crowd of people that you don't know but you sense an affinity with, that's all you need. Yeah, we all want to be part of a tribe.
But it's much more microscopic. Even if it is casual, it's just Cork.
Mm.
It's, oh, that guy's aunt lives two doors over. You know, this guy works down here. It's transplanted again when it's a province, a national team, when they're not part of the community, they're professional athletes. It's not a criticism. It's just a reality. I think, look, it's done really well. It's been really successful. It's a huge success story for rugby. But I think sometimes, and it shows up when things go bad, people get angry at what they perceive to be a sense to kind of colonise our sporting affections and our deep affinities to things when maybe they haven't quite been earned to the same degree.
Christ almighty. I mean, can we not just enjoy it when it goes?
Well, that would be my take. It's an Irish team playing. You're going to cheer for them. I wouldn't care what sport they were playing.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying this is what I think. I'm saying this is what I think or speculate maybe annoys some people.
When will the revolution start?
Who knows? I think it's in the process already.
Okay. Petrol bombs at the ready. What about Russia tomorrow? Look, 5 points minimum. It's going to happen. Wes, just like what? Give me a 30-second preview, of the Russia game. Notwithstanding the fact that I thought we were going to wallop Japan too. Well, not wallop, but
I mean, it's hard to see anything other than a conclusive win. You would think, you'd hope. Equally, it's hard on the back of that to kind of read too much into that.
What can we get out of it apart from the 5 points?
I don't know. Managing the squad, getting people to peak for a game that may or may not happen 2 weeks down the line in a quarter final, getting game time into some, maybe seeing a few combinations in action and getting a bit of a feel good back into the camp.
Eddie?
I don't have much in us for tomorrow except the 5 points. We've got to get the 5 points. I think we'll get them. The problem is for tomorrow is that getting the 5 points doesn't do anything for us other than get the 5 points. It doesn't solve the problem that seems to exist.
No.
That if things go wrong in a game, we can fix them. I think we just have to get tomorrow with our belt. There might be some, if we run in 60 points like we did in 2011 against them, you know, there might be some feel-good factor. But, you know, looking back to the build-up to the Scotland game, we all felt, you know, this could be one that Scotland would, you know, get us. But Scotland were abysmal. But to look at that game, through the reaction of everybody as well, oh, it was a great start, we were wonderful, Scotland were as good as we let them be. I think Scotland are in a bad place. We took too much out of that game.
Yes.
We congratulated ourselves too much, which is understandable given the pressure and the build-up, the potential for maybe getting caught on the day. You can see how we would like embrace the victory and the nature of it as everything's back
but
on
it was,
track.
But it's beginning to look like a one-off.
They were a bad team, and Japan were a better team, gives them a tougher test, and we came up short. So the problem is, even if we butcher Russia tomorrow, which I expect we will, by 50 or 60 points, it doesn't take away the annoying kind of feeling that if we find ourselves in the corner again later in the tournament, we might be able to dig ourselves out of it, that our best chance of success in this tournament in the quarter final is to get our nose in front and stay there. But that's, as I said, a different discussion. So tomorrow, yeah, I think, is of really not much value except the 5 points that will put ourselves, you know, back in the position we want to be. That's about the size of it, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, that's pretty realistic. And you know what we might have in this? It's great World Cup in terms of the fun and the debate and the cultural reflections that come into it, never mind what happens on the pitch. So we'll have another week of fun and discussion. And it is, I suppose, it's a bit of realism after being super gloomy and then super optimistic. We're back to being realistic. We're an ordinary team. On our day, we have a chance. and that's about it.
Yeah, we're very inconsistent at the minute.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, guys. Thanks for that. We're on air at 10:30 tomorrow for Ireland versus Russia. Kickoff is at 11:15 and it's live on Radio 1 as well. Thanks to Wesley Liddy and thanks to Eddie O'Sullivan, and hope you can join us in the morning. Not too bright and early, 10:30. If you can get around to it, we'll be there waiting for you on RTE2. Till then, go easy.